So, welcome back. Remember, we had found out how to solve a quantum field theory on an expanding space-time. And then we looked at the first observables. I mean, the first observables that came to mind, and they were the number operators. Number operator that counts how many particles of what momentum. And then we found that maybe that's not the most interesting observable to look at. Because either the universe is too tame to show something interesting in the number operator, or it's way too wild to show something interesting in the number operator. Because as the universe is expanding now, it's not producing particles. We've not seen any particles to be produced. And this actually led us to the definition of the adiabatic vacuum rather than the instantaneous lowest energy vacuum state as the real vacuum state, as the no particle state. On the other hand, the universe wasn't always adiabatic. At the very beginning, as we will later see in this course, the evidence points to an enormous expansion at the very beginning. And that was for sure not adiabatic. But it was so non-adiabatic that the harmonic oscillators flipped and were like this. And then we don't even have a particle interpretation anymore, because the Heydegger operators do not create particles on top of a vacuum state in this case. So the particle picture is of limited utility in cosmology. Of course, we will later have to answer the question, where did all this stuff come from, like atoms and photons and so on? And we will find probably not from quantum fluctuations, probably not from a non-adiabaticity, but instead from the decay of a potential that was a lot of energy. That potential was elevated because of a fluctuation, but just one fluctuation. Anyway, we will come back to the question of where did all this stuff, all the matter come from later. For now, let's ask, so if the number operator is not so interesting for a scalar field that's evolving on a curved or expanding space-time, what observables might be important? And what will be very important is the observable of the field itself, the amplitude of the field. Remember that for the harmonic oscillator too, you can measure positions and momenta. The positions would be like the amplitude of the harmonic oscillator. Or you can measure n, Heydegger A. These are different observables, which in fact don't commute. The number operator doesn't commute with x or with p. OK, so we switch now to the prediction for the observable, which is the amplitude of the field. And as we will see later on in the course, those predictions are going to be super important because they predict the inhomogeneities in the early universe and therefore the seeds for the condensation of the earliest matter into galaxies and stars, and also the structure in the cosmic microwave background radiation. Now, what you might expect is that the Klein-Gordon field, being a quantum field, is automatically always fluctuating. Or is it? Let's just convince ourselves that it does fluctuate, because maybe it doesn't, right? So why might it not fluctuate? Consider from first quantization a quantum system such as a harmonic oscillator, which is in an eigenstate of its amplitude. So it's in a position eigenstate. It's in a Dirac delta eigenstate. In that case, does it fluctuate? No. If you measure the position, knowing that the state is a position eigenstate, well, then you're going to find that exact position for sure. Because the wave function in position space is completely localized where the Dirac delta is peaking, so therefore, no fluctuations. Maybe we can arrange the same thing for a field. Maybe a field could be in a field eigenstate, where we can predict with certainty that if we measure the amplitude here, that's what we will find. If we measure the amplitude there, that's what we will find. The amplitudes are completely predetermined because the state is an eigenstate of all the field operators. Let's try that. So let's pick a function that describes, that we want to describe, the amplitude of the field everywhere. So that's a function that gives us, for all points in R3, everywhere in space, the amplitude of that field at some given time, eta naught. And then we define, or we consider, that state in the Hilbert space, which is eigenstate to all of the field operators. And there is a state that's, there are states that are eigenstates to all of the field operators because these guys are commuting with each other. So we can find a joint eigenstate of all of the field operators such that if we pick a field operator, for example, phi hat at a point x, then f is an eigenstate to phi hat x with this preordained eigenvalue f of x. So f is a state in the Hilbert space, which is such that it is simultaneously eigenstate to all of the field operators. And if we pick a field operator, the eigenvalue that it gives us is this value f of x. Then let's calculate what the expectation value is of the field, if we could measure the field when the field is in that state f. So we calculate phi bar by calculating the expectation value. So we put the state left and right as a Branicket, and then the field operator in the middle. And so we measure, so we calculate, we predict now the expectation value for the outcome of a measurement of phi hat of x. So we measure the field at x. And how do we calculate that? Well, we know that when phi hat of x acts on f, it produces this eigenvalue f of x. So we can pull this in front, and then assuming that we normalize the state, this is just f of x. So indeed, if the field is prepared in this field eigenstate, then we can predict that the expectation value of a measurement of the field operators is indeed as we wanted it to come out. But how about fluctuations? So for that, we need to calculate the variance. And the variance is also an expectation value. It's the expectation value of the squared difference between the actual and the mean value. The mean value we just determined is given by f of x. And so we have phi hat minus phi bar. That's just a number. But the phi hat acts on the f, producing the f of x. So overall, it's an f of x minus f of x situation. It's zero, so no fluctuations. So just like with a first quantized system, if we are in an eigenstate, then there are no fluctuations in that observable to which we are in an eigenstate. So it seems that, yeah, we can't be so sure that the quantum field is fluctuating. Maybe it's not, because maybe it's in an eigenstate of the field operators. But can that really be? It turns out it cannot. Those states f are not physical. They cannot be reached, at least not with a finite energy budget. It turns out that the Hamiltonian, the expectation value of the Hamiltonian is infinite. It's actually even worse because the energy density is even infinite, not just the overall integral, but the energy density is infinite. And why would that be? Well, I leave it to you as an exercise to prove that, but I give you a hint that's so much of a hint that it should be obvious how to do it. So for these states, we have the delta phi is equal to zero. By the uncertainty principle, it means that delta pi has to be infinite. But what is delta pi? Well, that's the expectation value of pi squared minus the square of the expectation value of pi. Expectation value of pi is zero. So it's the expectation value of pi squared. But remember that the Hamiltonian contains pi squared, the operator pi squared. So if that expectation value is infinite because of the uncertainty principle, so is the expectation value of the energy. So therefore, No, with a finite energy budget, we cannot have a field in any eigenstate. In particular, also not in the eigenstate where all amplitudes are zero, for example. Right? I could choose this f of x function to be the function that's everywhere zero. If the field was in that state, it would mean that wherever we measure, we find that the amplitude is zero. That, too, is a state of infinite energy. It's nowhere near the vacuum state. But that shouldn't surprise us, because setting the field equal to zero is forcing an eigenstate to an observable, namely phi, which is not commuting with the number operator. So if you have two non-commuting observables and you're looking at the eigenstate of one, the other one has to be very uncertain, like the particle number. Okay, so we can't really have eigenstates of the field, and that means we can't really have non-fluctuating field configurations, not for any finite energy budget anyway. So that means we should calculate how much of the of quantum fluctuations should we expect. How can we predict that? How strong the quantum fluctuations are going to be? And there, we must start with the realization that we can never measure the field amplitude at a point, because we don't have instruments that are point-like. Even if you take a pin, yes, its tip is not a point. It's at least the size of an atom, and an atom is giant. It's like 10 to the minus 10 meters. But we can probe things that are much smaller than that. At the LHC, we now probe 10 to the minus 20 meters. That's way, way, way pointier. But it's still not a point. So we will never be able to measure the field amplitude at a point, because we always work with some instrumentation. Therefore, let us describe more realistically what a measurement could accomplish. A measurement could measure the field not at a point, but in a region, and it would average over that region. For example, the tip of a pin would measure, I don't know, the electric field or something like that, but averaged over the last atom, perhaps, of that tip of the pin. And we can't resolve what's in there. We just integrate that up. So the mathematical description is this. What we are measuring is not phi hat of x. What we are measuring is a phi hat of b, where b is a region over which we average. And we describe this operator as the integral over the field operator's phi hat of x times a windowing function w of x. And the w of x is zero almost everywhere, except in that region where we perform the measurement. So it's a function that is like a box function, for example, which would be zero outside the box, and it would be like one over the volume inside the box, so that you, when you integrate over everything, then the integral is one. So the window function could be approximately zero, or even equal to zero, if you prefer, for all x outside the box. And it could be approximately, or if you prefer, equal to 1 over v, if v is the volume, for all x in the box. Then if we integrate w over all of space, we get 1. It doesn't have to be a box, of course, and later we will find it convenient to make this a ball, because for integration purposes, it's easier to use spherical coordinates when you have multiple dimensions.
Mm-hmm. Why would you choose zero, approximately zero versus actually zero, or what's
yeah, we get to the yeah, we will get to that as in a moment. The thing is this, that if you look at the Fourier transform of a function where this is equal to zero, then you find that the Fourier transform has long tails because of the sharp cutoff there. In order to describe a sharp cutoff, long tails. But we will want to do an approximation where we want to neglect the tails, and therefore it might be useful to soften this a little bit. In fact, today we will do some crude approximations and we will use tricks like that all the time. Good that you already anticipate what's coming up. Okay, now when we average over fluctuations, we should expect a phenomenon that's similar to what people on ships and boats experience. For example, this little boat there is going to bob up and down and left and right and everything much more than the big one. Because waves that are of the size of the little boat will totally whip it. But waves of that wavelength that would whip that boat don't do anything to the big one. Basically, the big one is exposed to them, but since it's in effect averaging them out over a big area, the averaged out version of these smaller waves adds up to almost zero. So what that means is that we expect that when we do this averaging here, and it's just like with the boat, and the most important contribution to these fluctuations are of the order of the size of the boat. Like if there is a big wave going like this, it will totally catch that boat and it will rock in those waves. So actually what we could do is we could in principle do we could have an armada of boats from tiny to big, and then we measure how much they are rocking in the waves, and from that we could reconstruct what the spectrum is of these waves there. But generally speaking, what matters most is the waves that are of the order of magnitude of that boat. Now for a ship, for the ocean, the wave spectrum might look something like this. Or let's say it's not the same, right? We're not simply saying that the boat is doing the Fourier transform. It's actually averaging things out. It's still feeling all waves. It's just not equally. So what we can plot, for example, is the rocking amplitude of the boats as a function of the size of the boat. And then generally we have the trend, of course, that the bigger the boat, the more calm it will appear. So the rocking amplitude will go down eventually. And what exactly that curve is depends on the weather, of course. Now similarly, we can ask, what's the rocking amplitude, or in other words, what is the size of the fluctuations? That is to say, what is the variance or standard deviation of that observable, that integrated field amplitude, as a function of the size of the box that we use. That's similar to choosing different size boats. And what we will find over today's and the next lecture is this general behavior for quantum field theories. If we plot the rocking amplitude or the standard deviation of that smeared field, if we plot that over the size of the boat or the size of the box here, then we find that, yes, it's very much like the boats. Namely, the bigger the box, the less it rocks. The bigger the boat, the bigger the box, the smaller is the standard deviation of the quantum fluctuations of the field that is averaged over a box of that size L. It actually goes essentially like 1 over L. And that's the reason why in daily life, where L is relatively large, we don't see quantum fluctuations of fields all over the place. We are far down that end here. On the other hand, in a quantum optics lab, you can easily ride up that mountain and see the quantum fluctuations. If you have a friend who is a quantum optics experimentalist, talk to them. I did. And it's great because they can bring it to the lab and then show you a quantum homodyne detector. And with that quantum homodyne detector, you can measure electric fields and magnetic fields. So not the number operator, what you're measuring is the field amplitude. Right? That's the operator that you measure. Quantum optics folks call this the quadratures. The E field is a quadrature and the B field is a quadrature. Or for a harmonic oscillator, X would be a quadrature and P would be a quadrature. So they measure that. And so it's like a very, very sensitive camera, which is, they don't really use it as a camera, but you know, to measure electromagnetic field strength. And what you can do is you can take its opening, its objective, so to speak, which is a half mirror, and you block it off so that it gets no light whatsoever. But you crank up the sensitivity of your instrumentation. And eventually, you find, beyond the thermal noise, what you find is this. And you find these quantum fluctuations. It's very cool because they are truly random. They are quantum random. And there are companies that produce quantum-induced random numbers in this way. You could also do it with radioactivity, but who wants to have a box with radioactive materials? Much better and more elegant to do it with light, especially with light in the darkness. Okay, so that's that behavior. You see quantum fluctuations of any field, electromagnetic or Klein-Gordon field, for very small distances. It diverges, in fact, for L going to zero. Of course, we can't go to L equal to zero, but we see how this rises. And then it decays very steeply, also like 1 over L for large boxes. And then we will ask, what, though, happens when the universe is expanding? And dramatically, what we will find is this. We will find that this behavior is the same, the so-called ultraviolet behavior. This is to say the small L behavior, small distance behavior is the same. But at a certain critical length, and that's the Hubble length, that's that length between which observers can no longer communicate because of the expansion of the universe. If you have wavelengths that are larger than that, then their quantum fluctuations do no longer diminish. The size of their quantum fluctuations plateaus during an accelerated expansion. And what that means is that if that phenomenon happens so dramatically that the Hubble length is very, very small, so if the horizon size in the universe is very small, because it's expanding so dramatically that even close-by observers cannot communicate anymore with each other, then this plateau kicks in even further to the left, right? And that means that we have then pretty large amplitudes all the way to large scales. In principle, all the way, I mean, it never stops, right? All the way to like cosmological scales. Billions of light years even. But how large the amplitude is depends on how early it kicks in. Now, let's say it kicks in, let's say we have a horizon size of just 1 meter. Can you imagine how fast the universe has to accelerate so that even two observers that are sitting like you both, 1 meter apart, can no longer communicate because light is not fast enough to cross your distance because of the expansion between you, right? So that would be extremely dramatic, but not enough. Not enough to make an appreciable effect, because how big are the quantum fluctuations at 1 meter wavelengths? Not noticeable in daily life, right? They're not strong. No, in order to actually make a difference, the universe has to accelerate so dramatically that the Hubble length, the horizon size, is so small that at those small distances, the quantum fluctuations are really large. We have to be really high up over there. And if we are, right, if that happens, then the plateau is all the way up here, and that means that we have that strong fluctuations all the way to even cosmological scales. And that's what we will find, that the universe apparently accelerated so dramatically that that plateau started so high up that the quantum fluctuations were appreciably large, and then of course at all scales, all the way up to cosmological scales, and then thereby imprinted inhomogeneities into the universe. Okay, that's just to anticipate, we will have to work that out in detail, of course. Okay, so how can we calculate these things? Let's use the machinery that we have. We use conformal time and co-moving coordinates. We choose a region B in space-time at a particular point in time. And let's say that region B is of size L by L by L. It's a box of size L by L by L. And if we do that, then this box is actually growing because we are working with co-moving coordinates. If in co-moving coordinates the box has size L, 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 then the proper distance, the actual distance, is A times L cross A times L cross A times L. It's a box that grows with the universe. We can go back and forth, and we will go back and forth between co-moving and proper distances. Further, let's assume that the system starts in a vacuum state. So let's say we pick a time, eta naught. We are not yet really making assumptions about how the Big Bang got started and all of that. Let's just say that at some early time, eta naught, the state of the system, let's call it omega, was the vacuum state at that time. And by that, we mean the adiabatic vacuum. If so, if it's the adiabatic vacuum, then it's of course convenient to choose those mode functions to solve our quantum field theory, to choose those mode functions whose associated operator, A, happens to be the one that annihilates the vacuum state. And we now know from the previous lecture how to calculate those mode functions. Namely, we have the initial conditions that we have to impose in the mode function at the time eta naught in order to achieve this. Okay, so the vacuum state, that is to say the initial state of the quantum field, and therefore the state of the quantum field at all times, is the state annihilated by our A operator. And we can in principle explicitly calculate what the V is because we have the initial conditions. We assume we know what the scale factor is as a function of time, which means we assume we know with the Klein-Gordon equation at all times, and therefore from the initial conditions for V we can calculate, if need be numerically, the mode function V at all times. So now let's calculate what the expectation value of this field operator here, the smeared field operator, is. What is the expectation value of that smeared field operator at any time, really? At the time eta naught or at later times? Well, the way we calculate that is that we calculate it as an expectation value. Omega is the state of the system. It's always the same state because we work in Heisenberg picture. It's the vacuum state at eta naught. It's the state that's annihilated by our A operators. All right, so we have the phi hat here. And we can write the state of the system as the vacuum at eta naught. We can also write it as the state zero that's annihilated by the A operators. And the smeared field observable, we can sub in from here, is that integral here. And the field phi, we can express in terms of chi. Phi is chi divided by A. And then we can expand the chi field in terms of the A and A daggers, like this, the mode function. And then what we obtain is that, well, the chi is an A plus an A dagger thing. And what we have is that the A dagger annihilates to the left, and the A annihilates to the right, so nothing's left. And the expectation value is zero, as one should have expected, because what it means is that if the phi b operator fluctuates, it fluctuates as much to the positive as much to the negative, right? There's no preference for positive over negative values. The expectation value is zero. But how big are the fluctuations around that? Well, for that, we need to calculate the variance, of our smeared field operator. And that's the vacuum or the state expectation value of the actual smeared field operator minus its expectation value, which we just calculated is zero. So it's just the expectation value in the state zero of that operator, which is time dependent, right? So we can calculate the size of these fluctuations at any point in time we want. And then we express this phi hat b of eta explicitly because we can express the phi hat in terms of the chi hat. Phi hat is chi hat divided by a. The square of it is chi hat squared divided by a. And we have the smearing function, the box function here, of course, as well. At this point, you need to plug in what the chi is in terms of the mode functions and the a and a dagger operators, and then square it. And there's a Fourier transform as well, if you want to express it in terms of the mode functions. So I skipped those steps. Please do it as an exercise. And then what you find is that this variance is given by this integral here, where we have the integral over all the mode functions squared and the w tilde, which is the Fourier transform of our window function. And that's where your point comes in. We will make assumptions about this w tilde. OK, so if you want to know how much the field is fluctuating averaged over a box, then that's what we need to calculate. And remember that the vk of eta is no mystery. We know how to calculate that, because at eta naught, we have the initial conditions for the differential equation from the adiabatic vacuum identification criterion of the previous lecture. And then the Klein-Gordon equation propagates that forward in time, if need be numerically. And the window function is no mystery either, because we choose it. So that integral is fixed. And then the scale factor function is our choice as well. So we can calculate all of that. Now, in order to actually calculate this, it's convenient to switch to spherical coordinates. But for that, it would be convenient if the window function was spherically symmetric. So let's now switch from a rectangular box to the assumption that the region B is actually spherical. And it has a radius, this sphere has, or this ball has a radius L. In this case, we can replace that d3k by dk, where k is the radius in momentum space. And then we have a sine phi, d phi, d theta. But there's nothing that depends on phi and theta, so we can integrate that out, and we just get a 4 pi. And the integral over the radius in momentum space, the integral measure is a k squared. So in spherical coordinates, the same integral is this one, where the k now is the radius in momentum space. So a k is the square root of k1 squared plus k2 squared plus k3 squared. And the window function is, by assumption, spherically symmetric, so it also only depends on that radius. Now, this is where we make an approximation. Remember that our window function could be just constant in the box and then sharply drop to zero. Or we can also soften it a little bit over there. But either way, we want to model somehow that we cannot resolve points, we can only resolve regions. So we'll give ourselves that freedom to describe that boundary in a fuzzy way. So what we will assume here is that the Fourier transform of the window function is essentially zero outside for any radii in momentum space that are larger than 2 pi over L. Now, what does that mean? Let's assume that the window function is actually sharp, sharply cutting off. So it's constant in the box and then drops sharply to zero. If this was a one-dimensional thing, it would look like this. And its Fourier transform is a so-called sinc function. Sinc is sine of x over x, right? So in this case, it's sine of kl over kl. That's how that looks. And it decays over there. There are just some wiggles here. And those wiggles decay like 1 over the argument. So it's not particularly slow that they decay. And what we will do for simplicity, in order to get a crude approximation of the size of the fluctuations, is that we can actually truncate that integral here at the value where k, we're integrating over k here, at the value where k is 2 pi over L. If the window function was just a box here, just a, you know, rectangular here, then this would be a sinc function. And this assumption that we can truncate that integral is to say that, oh, we just take the first bubble here and we neglect these tails there. But, and that's why I drew a little softer version here. Actually, if we make that decay a little softer, then the Fourier transform doesn't need all those high frequencies. In other words, the Fourier transform doesn't need all those tails of wriggles, and therefore it's an even better approximation to just keep the central bubble and not the stuff on the side. Okay, so we take that integral and we truncate it to integrating only to 2 pi over L. Remember that to every momentum there corresponds a wavelength, and that's how you convert between momentum and wavelength. And we will do more crude approximations. We observe that the integrand here is suppressed for small k values, because if k is really small, k squared is even smaller. And that happens for the small k values here. The integral is having most of its contributions, basically because the mode function is not changing very much from one k value to the other, but this k squared is changing a lot. So we say that, well, the main contribution here is the contribution up here at the upper end of the integral. And therefore, we will approximate by saying that we will simply replace the value of that integrand here by the value it has at the top. That's a crude approximation, admittedly, but you will soon see why we do that. We just basically want to push through this with even crude approximations so that we can arrive at definite statements without having to leave stuff as integrals. So we replace that by its value where it matters most. And that is to say, we replace it by its value where k is equal to 2 pi over L. So we now have that the variance is calculated by this integral, where this value here is fixed at where it matters most. And now we can carry out the integral, because it's just an integral over k squared. And that gives us a 1/3 k to the third to be evaluated at that value, which means that the k to the third becomes a 1 over L to the third, right? And that's what we get here. So we finally have an end result, namely that the variance is approximately, admittedly a crude approximation, but all we're really interested in is the scaling behavior, is given by these prefactors, and then it goes like 1 over L to the third power, and then the mode function evaluated at 2 pi over k, at 2 pi over L. So that's a k value. The k value 2 pi, the k is equal to 2 pi over L. So it's the wavelength corresponding to the momentum k. divided by the scale factor. Right, because here we have an a squared here, we have a v squared there, we can combine the two. But the mode function divided by the scale factor is the mode function for the field phi. Remember, v is the mode function for the field chi. W is the mode function for the field phi itself. Right? Because the relationship between phi and chi is this. Chi over a is phi. OK, so what's the conclusion so far? Just a sec, checking. Yeah, microphone's on. What's the conclusion so far? OK, we assume that at the time eta naught, the system was in the vacuum state. We chose the mode function such that the corresponding A operator is annihilating a corresponding zero vector, which is the vacuum state at that time. And then we can calculate the size of the quantum fluctuations, namely the variance of the smeared field operator. And we obtain this expression for it, namely 2 pi over 3 L to the third power. And here we have the mode function of the chi field. Here we have the mode function of the phi field, which is just, you know, the V over A evaluated at time eta. And so as the time evolves, the amplitude of the mode function may grow or shrink. And that would have an impact on the fluctuations, on the variance of the quantum fluctuations. I drew the box again, but remember, actually, the L stands for a sphere of that same volume, or a similar volume. In any case, the prefactors are not exactly right because we did some crude approximations. Let's study that for a particular case, namely Minkowski space. There we know everything about the mode function. We know that the mode function of the chi field is the same as that as of the phi field because the scale factor is 1. So the chi is the phi field, just one mode function. The conformal time is the proper time in Minkowski space. And we know that the modulus of the mode function is given by 1 over square root of omega, or the modulus squared, which is what we need here, is given by 1 over omega. And in the massless case, that's 1 over k vector. And this is, if you translate that momentum into a wavelength, as we did all along, this is L over 2 pi. So that term over here is L over 2 pi. But there is an L to the third power here. So what that means is that the size of the fluctuations, the variance of the fluctuations, goes like 1 over 3 L squared. Or if we take the square root to obtain the standard deviation, we find that the standard deviation of the fluctuations goes like 1 over L. Hence, this picture that we saw earlier, that we were anticipating. So no big quantum fluctuations at large box sizes, but the quantum fluctuations grow and grow and grow, even diverge as we make the box smaller and smaller. Would we have gotten the same result if space didn't have three dimensions? Let's say if it had had 26 dimensions. What would we do? You see a way in which the number of dimensions entered into our calculations? There was. Right? Because when we went to the spherical coordinates, remember? We went to the spherical coordinates, what we had is we had this integral, right? We went from, where is it? Here. From d3k to dk, spherical coordinates. And everything would be the same in any number of dimensions, except that power here would be different. Instead of k squared, if space dimension was one less, then we would have here only a k And that would propagate all the way through. If we had a higher number of dimensions, we would have a higher power there. And correspondingly, what that would mean is that in higher dimensions, and I invite you to do that as an exercise, in higher dimensions, this ultraviolet divergence would be worse. It would go more steeply because the power is higher here. Right? Because k to the so many powers translates into 1 over L to so many powers. So it gets it's a worse divergence at small distances. And of course, it also decays faster than over here. So very importantly, there is a dimension dependence. In fact, if we dropped 2 space dimensions, then we would have a logarithmic behavior. It wouldn't be L to the 0. You see, it's an L squared. If you drop the dimension, it would be L. And 1 more wouldn't be nothing. It would be logarithmic. Okay, so we've done this now for Minkowski space. We will later also do this, well, not today, but we will later also do this then for FRW spacetimes. And you know, remember, the point was that if there's a horizon in the spacetime because it accelerates, then there is this plateauing. And that's what we want to see happen. But before we do that, let's take another view at this. Let's study the fluctuations also in a different way. Here we studied the fluctuations by saying, well, we average the field over a box and then look at the fluctuations. It's like taking a big ship and see how much it rocks in the sea, and then taking a smaller ship, an even smaller ship, or bigger ships, and so on. And that's what we calculated there. But there is another way of studying the quantum fluctuations. And that's by studying the correlation functions. That's in fact the way that we study the cosmic microwave background. There we have temperature fluctuations in the sky. And to study them, we can calculate the correlation function of the temperatures. So for example, if I notice that in this direction, it's a little bit elevated, the temperature. Now, before looking at what the temperature is 1.5 degrees over, what would be my prediction? Is it still elevated there, or could it perhaps be anti-correlated over there? It might actually be predictable that it's most likely below average temperature over there. And you can ask that for every opening angle. You can ask, if I know what the temperature here is, does that bias what the temperature over there might be, right? That's what two-point correlators are all about. Now, before we do that for quantum fields, calculate the two-point correlators, let's look at the two-point correlators in isolation, information theoretically. And then we use what we learned there for quantum fields. So imagine a source of noise. So you have a box, and it produces noise. And what kind of noise, that's a secret that only the box knows. Right? And every time you switch on the box, it produces noise, and the function looks something like this. Right? So that's what it does. And the next time you switch on the box, it produces also some noise. And it looks something like that, etc. Every time you switch on the box, it does that. Then we can ask, in order to examine that noise, we can ask, if I measure the noise at time t1, and I measure the noise amplitude at time t2, then are these amplitudes correlated or not? And what does it mean? It means that if I check the next time at t1 and t2, and then the next time, Right? I switch on the box again, it does its thing. And again at T1 and at T2, I measure the amplitudes, right? And then I want to know, are they correlated or not? If I know what the amplitude is elevated here, does that give me an edge in predicting what the amplitude is over here? That's what the correlator tells me. If the correlator comes out zero, it means I have no edge. Just because I know what the amplitude there is doesn't help me predict what it might be there. So what is the correlator then? Well, what I take is if this is phi of t, and this is t, or let's call it f. This is f of t. No, actually, n I'm using here. So noise, it's a noise signal, n of t. So I take n of t1, and I multiply that with n of t2. And then let's say I'm calculating, let's say it's t. Let me stick to the notation t plus t and t plus l. T and t plus l. So this is t, and this is t plus l, t plus l, t plus l, right? So this distance is l. Okay, so I'm looking at the amplitude at t and multiply with the amplitude at t plus l, and then I take the average of that. So I switch on my machine, my noise machine, and measure that. And then I switch it on again and measure these values. And every time I do switch on the machine, I record those two amplitudes, I multiply them, and I calculate the overall average of that. Now, imagine that this noise is fluctuating around zero. So we have that n bar of t is equal to zero for all t. So it's just as likely to be positive, the noise, as it is to be negative. Then what do we expect? Well, if the amplitude here is uncorrelated to the amplitude there, then it's just as many times positive as negative, independent of what that is, which means that this average should come out zero if uncorrelated. If, however, whenever this amplitude is positive, the amplitude there is also usually positive. And if this amplitude, when it is negative, this one is also more often than not negative, then it means that this product is either positive times positive or negative times negative, in both cases positive, which means it's larger zero if correlated. Could also be anti-correlated, right? If there's positive there, then there could be a larger than 50-50 chance that it's negative over here, and vice versa. And that would mean that the correlator is negative. Okay. All right, so that's how correlations are defined. And in practice, though, how do we calculate it, though? If we have a model of the noise, then how do we calculate what that is, whether we have correlations or not? Now, let's assume that the noise is Gaussian. N of t is Gaussian. Band-limited noise. What that means is that the amplitudes are distributed according to a Gaussian. And the Fourier transform of your noise has no frequencies above a certain band limitation. So let's say band limitation is omega. Okay, so this is noise that has only frequencies in a finite frequency range, band limited, and its amplitudes are Gaussian distributed. In fact, if you have lots of sources of noise that are not Gaussian and you add them up, it's Gaussian noise. There's a theorem about that. So any kinds of noises, if you add them up, they become Gaussian. All right, so let's assume that that is the case. Gaussian band-limited noise. That's like the vanilla kind of noise. It happens all the time. In that case, one can calculate that the correlator, so n times n of t plus l, the expectation value, is actually what is written there. It is the sine of omega t divided by omega t. But remember, omega is the band limit. It's the bandwidth. It's the amount of frequencies that you're allowed to have in that noise. And how does that look? Well, it looks like this. If I plot it here, this should not be t. This should be l, of course. L, so if I plot this over l, and here is the n of t plus l bar, that's the correlator, it looks like this. It's a sinc function, sine x over x. That's how that looks, which means that for this Gaussian band-limited noise, you have that the amplitudes close to where you measured it first, so close to it, they're very much correlated. Then there is a particular distance L where they're uncorrelated. Then we become anti-correlated, correlated, uncorrelated, anti-correlated, etc. That's just how that noise behaves. And you may wonder, how do we calculate that? Where does this come from? Well, here's how we calculate that. And I'll tell you now something which is super important in all of information theory. First of all, this particular noise model, so if our black box that produces the noise is producing Gaussian band-limited noise, then we can say that it is what is called ergodic. And what ergodic means is that you don't need to bother switching your noise machine on and off all the time. You don't have to switch it on, measure here, switch it on, measure there, switch it on, measure there. No, no, no. You have time translation invariance, and one run of the experiment is sufficient. Instead of doing the statistics this way, that, and so on, the average, no, you just take these two, those two, those two, those two, those two, etc. You get the same expectation if you just take the same signal and keep going as if you took fresh signals and then averaged that way. Okay, so let's do that. Not every noise is ergodic, but this one is. So let's calculate it then. So we have n of t times n of t plus l, expectation value, and using ergodicity, we will calculate it by integrating over the time, by just shifting it along the signal. So it's the integral over dt of f of t plus l. So we hold the distance fixed between the two sample points, but we integrate over all t. And you may have to regulate that in order to get a finite answer. And then what we do is we replace the f of t with its, I mean, we ex, not replace, we ex, we Fourier expand the f of t in here, and we Fourier expand the f of t plus l in here. So we obtain an f tilde of omega, that's the Fourier transform, times e to the power I omega t, an integrate over omega. And here, that can also be written as the f tilde of omega prime, and then e to the power I omega prime t plus l. And again, the omega integral. Notice that I adopted the notation that you would find in the information theory literature, which is engineering literature, the most part of it, which means the Fourier transform doesn't have a 1 over square root of 2 pi. Right? Just to remind you, do always be careful when you look up a table of Fourier transforms, because you might be off by a factor of square root of 2 pi. Remember, in physics, you always have a 1 over square root of 2 pi, no matter whether it's the forward or the backward Fourier transform. The engineers don't do it forward, and then they get 2 pi in the backward way. All right, so once we've expressed these two functions in terms of their Fourier transforms, then we can now carry out the t integral, which is the integral that we need to take the expectation value. So we do carry out the t-integral. The t only arises over here and over there. And that's a known dependence. So we just have the t-dependence in here. But if we integrate over t now, that just gives us the Dirac delta. It gives us the Dirac delta and omega plus omega prime. Could someone please close the door? Thank you. Okay, so we get a Dirac delta, and that means we can get rid of one of the omega integrals, and that means we obtain this result. And what is this? This is a positive function here, and we Fourier transform it, and we see that the correlation function, and since it's the correlation function between a function and itself, it's called the autocorrelator. This autocorrelator function is the Fourier transform of something. Of the Fourier transform of what? Well, f tilde of omega is the spectrum of our function f. And f tilde modulus squared is the modulus squared of the spectrum. In engineering, in information theory, the square of a function is called the power of it. And that's because usually the amplitude is something like the voltage or the current. And if you square that, it's proportional to the power in the wire. And if you integrate over time, for example, you get the energy. So this is the modulus squared of the spectrum. And it is therefore called the power spectrum. This is the power spectrum because it's the modulus squared of the spectrum. So this means that the autocorrelation function is the Fourier transform of the spectral power density. That's just generally always true, this relationship, at least when you can take the averages along the signal. So for example, what would that be? Well, for band-limited white noise, we have that the spectral power spectrum, that the power spectrum is just this box function. It has all the frequencies. This noise has all frequencies between plus and minus capital omega. And we know what the Fourier transform of that is. That's just the sinc function. And that's the sinc function that I claimed up here. Right? So the autocorrelation function is the sinc function. That's why, that's how we calculate that, you know, when you measure for small l, when you measure the amplitudes at very close by points, you're somewhere here for small l, then the amplitudes are very correlated. And then they become less and less correlated, not correlated at all, and then anti-correlated, correlated, etc. All right, so that's ordinary things to do with boxes that create noise. Now, back to quantum field theory. We can do a very similar thing. We can now take a field that fluctuates at x and a field that fluctuates at x plus l. I mean, the same field fluctuates now at the point x plus l. We multiply the two and calculate the vacuum expectation value. That's the two-point correlator now for fields. If that comes out positive, it tells us that whenever we measure a positive value for phi here, we have a better than average chance that the value of phi at x plus l is also positive. And if it's negative here, it's negative there. If this comes out negative, then, well, things have, then you have anti-correlation. OK, so let's calculate that. First of all, we express the phi in terms of the chi divided by a. So we have this. And then we make use of the mode expansion of chi hat. You know, we do the Fourier transform in co-moving momenta. We plug in the mode functions. And then we apply the a and a daggers to this state. And then after some calculations that you can easily do nowadays, you will be able to calculate that this two-point correlator is this integral, where in addition to the Fourier transform and evaluating operators on states, we've also switched to polar coordinates. So now we have that integral to work with, where again k is the modulus of the momentum 3 vector, and L is the modulus, is the length of the position 3 vector L. Again, just like we did for the variance, let's do some crude approximations now, and just to see how things are scaling. But now we don't have a ball or a cube or a box. Now we just have the distance between two sample points. And that translates indirectly via a lot of work into the correlations between temperatures on the cosmic microwave background, as we will see much later in the course. All right, so in this integral here, we notice again a dimension dependence. This would not be k squared. It would be k to a different power if we had a different number of dimensions. Just very similar to what we had in the variance calculation before. Also, we notice that here we have a sinc function, which, remember, has a central bubble where it's more or less of order 1. And then outside of that, there are these small tails that we may want to neglect. So again, we truncate that integral so that we no longer integrate from 0 to infinity, but only to, we just truncate it to up to here. And then also, that integral here has its largest amplitude where the sine has its largest amplitude there in that integral. And that's, at the upper end of the integral. So we replace the vk of eta, again, as we did previously, by the v evaluated at the boundary there. And that gives us this expression here, which should look a little similar to what we had before for the variance. So let's look at Minkowski space. What is the correlator between field fluctuations of a distance L in Minkowski space? The mode function is the v, it goes like 1 over square root of omega. So v squared goes like 1 over omega. 1 over omega is like 1 over k. If we plug that into here, and remember that the k is to be evaluated at 2 pi over L, we obtain that this two-point correlation function is actually approximately, remember we approximated stuff here, a third 1 over L squared, which happens to be the exact same expression as what we had for the variance before. In fact, even with the one-third there. There was no reason to get the one-third right as well, but it just came out this way. So if we plot the two-point correlator now as a function of the distance, then if we take the square root of it, if we take the square root of that correlator, then we get that it goes like 1 over L squared. That's the massless case, right? In the massive case, we have that the omega is not just 1 over k, it's omega is square root of k squared plus m squared. Okay, so it's that. Now, this means that the variance, in fact, scales the same way as does the correlator. Both are a good measure of the quantum fluctuations. And therefore, we now adopt a definition. Namely, we define the so-called fluctuation spectrum of a quantum field such as the Klein-Gordon field. And we define the fluctuation spectrum with a new notation. We write delta phi k of eta. And what we pick here is the square root of the correlator, or the square root of the variance, which is the standard deviation. And it goes like 1 over a, and then some irrelevant factors of 12 pi squared. So it goes like 1 over a squared, k to the third power, and then the modulus squared of the mode function. But if we take the square root of this, then we get 1 over a, k to the power 3 half, and just the modulus of the wave function. And that's what we adopt. We say that the fluctuation, the size of the fluctuations is, by definition, up to these prefactors, It is, by definition, 1 over a squared, k to the power 3 half, and then the modulus of the mode function. If you multiply with the suitable prefactors, you can interpret this directly as the approximate standard deviation or as the approximate two-point correlator's square root. Now, next time we will continue this with the expanding space-time. This is so far just Minkowski space. The formulas will always apply here, but we only applied them to Minkowski space. But what we can still do today is, just as an exercise, and also because you might be interested in this for your project, if you want to incorporate any of this, let's see how the fluctuation spectrum would be impacted if we take into account the mass of the Klein-Gordon field. So we give it a mass, then what? Well, so here's the definition of the fluctuation spectrum. 1 over a, k to the 3 half, modulus of the function. Then this is, in the case of having a mass, it would not be just, it would be this expression and then the modulus of the mode function. The mode function goes like 1 over square root of omega, but omega is square root of k squared plus m squared. So if you plug that in here, that's what we get. So the fluctuation spectrum in the presence of a mass goes like this. Before we go through the math and find out what it does, do you have any idea what the mass might do? So if you go to very short wavelengths, for example, would the mass matter? Or if you go to very large wavelengths, would the mass matter? Now, it turns out that for long wavelengths, the quanta of the field have little energy, right? For long wavelengths, little energy in the quanta. And that means that the mass might be the dominant part of the field. But for short wavelengths, for large k, the quanta have a lot of energy whether or not they have a mass. It's like a relativistic, highly ultra-relativistic electron. It behaves as if it was massless, almost. It travels at almost the speed of light, and the mass just doesn't contribute much to its energy because its energy might be mostly determined by its kinetic energy, not by its mass energy. So what we would expect is that the fluctuation spectrum too is impacted by the mass only in the infrared end, where we have low energy particles, long wavelength fields. But in the ultraviolet, where everything is already very highly energetic, the mass should not play a role, not even for the quantum fluctuations. And that's what we find. So here's the fluctuation spectrum as a function of k. And what we find is that for large k values, the mass doesn't matter in the denominator because this k squared is way larger than it. And then we have that it's just like this, and those guys just give us the k as before, as in the massless case. But when there is a mass, then for small k, this term doesn't matter anymore. It goes like k to the power 3 half. And that means that for small k, which means for large L, we have an even steeper decay. So that means that we have that there is a divergence here, as always, that goes like 1 over L squared, 1 over L in the ultraviolet. As if there was no mass, there was also the 1 over L behavior. But for large Ls, the behavior is decaying faster. What that means is that if the field has a mass, then quantum fluctuations are energetically more expensive, and they don't happen as much. So that's the impact of a mass. Now, when I plot this, or when you plot this, and you probably plot it nicer than I do, but it's hard to see that this is a 1 over L behavior here and a 1 over L to the power 3 half behavior there. How can you tell by just looking at it, right? It's hard to see. And I would like to just introduce you to a little tool, a mathematical tool, so that you can, in a case like this, see the scaling behavior change. And the way that works is that if you have one scaling law here, another scaling law there, so you're interested in scaling laws, that's when you use a log-log plot. Right? So a log-log plot works like this. One variable is the logarithm, of k. I'm doing the log-log for the k picture, not the l picture, right? We could also do it for the l picture, but let's do the log-log for the k. So we want to plot this. So I use the argument, the log of the argument, and the log of the output, right? So this is the output, the argument is k. I take the log of the output and the log of the argument, okay? So x is the log of the argument, y is the log of the output. Then I take the log of the logarithm of both sides of that equation. Then I have the log of the output on the left, that's the y. And here I have to take the logarithm, but that's easy, right? The logarithm of this, how does that behave? Well, the logarithm of this in the limiting cases is the logarithm of that or the logarithm of this. And so it's either the logarithm of k, which is directly the variable x, or it's the logarithm of k to the power 3/2. But that's easy because it's 3/2 k to the log, 3/2 times logarithm of k, which is x. Which means that the slope changes. It's a straight line at 45 degrees, and that's a straight line at a different angle. So we get that y is either equal to x, that's in the ultraviolet, or y is equal to offset plus 3/2 x, that's steeper. And if we plot that, we obtain this curve. It's a straight line here, and then a straight line there. That's in the infrared. Slope is 1 and slope is 1 in the ultraviolet, and slope is 3/2 in the infrared. So instead of a hyperbola, where it's not easy to see how the scaling law changes when you switch to log-log representation, then you get, as long as we're dealing with powers, you get straight line, and you get you can identify the region where the crossover happens. So that's sometimes convenient to do if you want to visualize things. Right, here's a bit of text, but I already mentioned that to you, namely that in the infrared, the mass plays a role because the mass makes quantum fluctuations more expensive. In the ultraviolet, the mass energy doesn't matter anymore because we have so much energy anyways. So the ultraviolet behavior never matters. In the ultraviolet, the mass doesn't matter, but in the infrared, it does. Now, if you look at the extreme here, let me just close with that. What if we take this seriously here, this 1 over L curve? Then what we would find is that fluctuations of the quantum field really get out of hand for small l. And then we can take these fluctuations of the field and plug them into the Einstein equation on the right-hand side. And then it means that we have fluctuations in the energy momentum tensor, which turn into fluctuations in the curvature on the left-hand side. And eventually, if we go far enough to the left, these fluctuations are so strong that you basically have black holes popping in and out of existence, because the fluctuations in the energy momentum tensor are strong enough to generate such dramatic fluctuations in the curvature on the left-hand side. And you can ask, just by order of magnitude, how far left do you have to go for this to happen? And it's 10 to the minus 35 meters. That's the Planck length where that happens. OK, so that's as far as we got today, the Planck length.